Okay, that's looking better.
Excellent.
Okay, that's looking better. And so I think one of the things about my system is that it really needs to be up and running for about 5 minutes before it's really stable. I need to take that to my local Windows guru and find out why that would be. It doesn't really seem reasonable to me. Okay. Once again, 3, 2, 1. Okay, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are or when you're watching this. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Peter Ballerstedt. And I first met Dr. Ballerstedt on the 2012 Low Carb Cruise, which turns out that he was very, very much interested in his background is such that he is naturally interested in low carb, high fat. Dr. Ballerstedt, I understand you graduated from a university in Kentucky,
Yes, University of Kentucky.
and you have a degree in forage agronomy.
Yes.
So anyway, I'm going to let you introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about how you came to be where you are now, and what is forage agronomy?
Well, let's see. Forages are those plants that are meant to be eaten by animals. Primarily, we're talking about ruminant animals, but any animal that can eat grass or clover or other forage legumes, not necessarily peas or beans, although they could certainly be harvested as the plant material and fed. There's some other members of the cabbage family, for example, are also used as forage crops. So any of those sorts of things. My degree included a minor in ruminant nutrition. It seemed logical to learn a little bit about the consumer, as well as the production. After 86, my wife Nancy and I moved from Kentucky to Oregon. I was the forage extension specialist there until 92. Spent some time then completely out of agriculture, but meanwhile gained a real personal interest and then a developing scientific interest in the realm of low carbohydrate, high fat diet as a means to treat all of the various symptoms of metabolic syndrome. And then in October of 2011, was fortunate enough to get back into agriculture here at Barron Brugg USA, working as their forage product manager.
Now, you say you had a personal interest in low carb, high fat as a treatment for metabolic syndrome. Did you have problems with that yourself?
I did. Fortunately, Nancy had been reading a number of blogs and books over the years for about 5 years, actually, before I was ready to start listening to the information that she had. Starting Christmas of 2007, I got serious and then started reading many of the books, including Good Calories, Bad Calories, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that started me on a journey of losing some 40 pounds and normalizing blood sugar and blood pressure and improving blood lipids and losing the sleep apnea, et cetera, et cetera. So became very interested. And then the funny thing was, started going to the farmers markets looking for the fatty cuts of meat. And we've got wonderful local producers, but at the time at least, they were all promoting their grass-fed beef as lean because that was part of the story. And we had to say, no, we'd like the fatty bits, please. And then that got me back into literally walking people's pastures and talking with them, and that got me reinterested in getting back into agriculture.
And then you discovered the low carb cruise going on, and you managed to get in on that. I take it you're also a fan of Jimmy Moore.
Oh, absolutely. I've read Jimmy for many years and corresponded off and on. Even got to visit him on one of my trips to the Southeast. So, yeah, it's always fun to spend time with Jimmy.
Yeah, I got to see him when I was up in North Carolina a couple of months ago at his book signing for his latest Cholesterol Clarity.
Keto Clarity?
Keto Clarity. Keto Clarity, yeah. The other one is the cholesterol, what the HDL was wrong with my numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is good. And I even wrote a review on both of those. Of course, as far as I was concerned, he was preaching to the choir. You have a blog, which is called, if I bring it up here, the Grass-Based Health.
Yes.
And you've got that on blogspot.com. The last, I was reading through your last article, which was from back in October, on the romance versus the reality of farming. I thought that was quite an interesting little opinion piece.
Well, there is, and that's part of the world that I get to walk in. I now occupy space between the low-carb, paleo, primal, however you want to describe that nutrition realm, and then agriculture. And I'm hoping that one of the roles that I can fill is to introduce those two to each other so that we can have conversations with each other. The fact is that if you are so blessed to be able to go buy some land and run a few animals and have a few fruit trees and grow a few vegetables, that's great. You know, I kind of would like to do some of that myself someday. But understand that that's more hobby than it is anything else. And that's great. That's fine. But, the trajectory for the world is that we're going to have to double our food production in the next, what would it be, 35 years, to reach the projected world population by 2050. How are we going to do that? That bad things happen when people start facing famine. And as an agriculturalist, I think that we can contribute to that in the forage agriculture sector. We aren't depending on limited land that can produce human utilizable feedstuffs, for example. We can produce high quality animal fat and high quality animal protein off of land that can't produce human utilizable foodstuffs. We can use a lot of what we would call byproduct feeds in the production of ruminant animal products. And then there's the whole question of what ought the nature of the human diet be? Is it, are we supposed to be eating carbohydrate-based diets, or are we supposed to be eating diets that are more based on animal products? I'm convinced we ought to be eating diets that are based on animal products, but then the next question is, how are we going to produce them? And unfortunately right now, there's so many conversations that are so cross-contaminated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that one of the places that we can start the conversation for most people is this area of what we've been taught is the healthy diet is demonstrably not. Mm-hmm. And then we can go from there, because a lot of the same messages are, well, let's put it this way. That idea of what's a healthy diet, in quotes, is used to justify a lot of other arguments. And it goes back and forth. And so now we have the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, that body which is going to be making recommendations for the 2015 dietary guidelines, is no longer trying to say that a low-fat diet is healthier. What they're now going to be they're going to be using as justification for advocating a plant-based diet, that is vegan or vegetarian, sustainability. So they're now explicitly saying that a plant-based diet is more sustainable. Human health be damned, one might say. But if you're willing to accept that we haven't been well served by the dietary experts,
I am,
then we could perhaps start having conversations about, well, is what we're being told about the environmental impact of ruminant agriculture as, you know, unsound as the dietary advice has been? And I think we can have that conversation, but unfortunately, it's contaminated so much of the conversation that we really need to go through a deliberate process of deconstructing all these narratives.
Yeah, there was a fairly good one, Vegetarian Myth by Lear Keith, and things like that. I think it can be convincingly demonstrated that a vegetarian or vegan diet is not sustainable, or at least not any more than meat eating, and it doesn't take any more resources.
Perhaps less, for the simple reason that we don't have the arable land to depend solely upon the production of human utilizable feedstuffs. And then you can start looking at the factoids that are thrown out about greenhouse gas emissions, and water use and all those sorts of things. They all become issues that can be refuted on a factual basis. And then you get into areas of, even if they were true, what would be the practical impact? And when you start looking at that, you realize that that can be factually refuted. And so it becomes this amazing house of cards where one argument is used to justify the other, but none of them are sound. I said at one of the ancestral health symposia, I said to Seth Roberts that as bad as the information, the data was that supported the low fat is heart healthy debacle, at least they had data.
they had to fabricate some of it.
They absolutely, you could argue about their selective interpretation. You could argue about how they did a number of things with data that one should not do if you're going to be an ethical scientist. But we're talking today about a controversy in which there's no experimental data. It's entirely model response. And the observational information entirely conflicts with the models. So if anything, the current debates are even worse than this one that we're trying so desperately to emerge from.
Yeah. Anyway, I was back to this article that you wrote about the romance versus the reality. One of the things that you mentioned was that people leave the farm and don't go back. Although there's a few of us that not me personally, my friend Scott Merritt. Did you meet Scott?
Yeah. Yes.
He is doing quite well on a small farm just about 20 miles north of here.
Yes. And there are, of course, many who have. But overall, the trend is otherwise. And that I wrote that particular post while visiting a part of the world where agriculture is no longer being practiced for all intents and purposes. Very small, scattered, whereas before it was mostly self-sufficiency. There's a reality to that, however, that people who have options choose typically to go somewhere else.
Farming is hard work.
Farming is very hard work. Self-sufficiency means you're on the edge all the time. One bad storm at the wrong time, and you're in big trouble. and it can be over in an afternoon of hail, for example, if you're self-sufficient on your crops and the hailstorm comes in and wipes out your crops, that's hours. And then you're in deep trouble, which again is one of the reasons that ruminant agriculture is a lot more resilient. If you lose a cutting of hay, well, there may still be three or four more. You're not dealing with a single harvest. You're dealing with multiple harvests throughout the season. In addition to the ecological niche that ruminants occupy in terms of being able to use cellulose, which we can't use.
Yeah. Anyway, I have a link to your blog on my site and my blog roll, which, by the way, is how you came to my attention about 6 months ago. I noticed that the link went dead, and we went back and forth, and you were having some problems trying to communicate with folks at Blogspot because you were not in the spot where you were supposed to be.
Yes, I was in that suspicious area called Canada, and I couldn't have both cell phone and wireless at the same time. And so you try to say, send me help me recover my password. And so they send it to you via cell phone. Well, I didn't have cell phone. And so we had to sort through all that for a while.
Yeah. Maybe you should seriously consider getting your own domain.
A possibility. One of the things I should seriously consider doing is writing more frequently on a more regular basis.
Hey, we're all guilty of that. Yeah. even the N equals one health problem with that one is, while it's a labor of love, I basically don't make any money off of N equals one. Mm-hmm. And I do make money off of my other ventures, but I just feel like I need to do something useful with N equals one. And that's one of the reasons why I was after you for an interview, because I wanted to get that information. And I think I mentioned to you that Jimmy and I spoke about you, and he said, oh, if you could come on the next cruise, you could be a featured speaker. I don't. You haven't made any commitments that I know of to be on that cruise.
No, and for me right now, it's hard to make blocks of time like that available, especially at certain times of the year. My day job is working in the seed industry, and there are certain times when you just must be available. I get to go around and as I said before, talk to agriculture. In some senses, you talk to the beef industry and, oh, yeah, we're all for this. But then you see the advertising that the 29 lean cuts of beef. And I think it was Nina Teichholz that coined that said perhaps they're suffering from the Stockholm syndrome. Mm-hmm. These people are believing that if they appeal to the leanness of their product, then the dietary opponents will leave them alone. Well, I think we have the answer now when we see the direction that the dietary guidelines, advisory committee is planning to go with. On the other side, one of the things that I've run across, and when I first came back in agriculture, of course, as a forage agronomist, I was all for grass-fed meat. That just hit all my selection bias buttons. But then I started reading some of the literature that people were citing when they made various health claims for grass-fed versus commercial beef. And I don't think that we have the scientific justification to stand on those claims. I think that if we are going to demand that other people be castigated for the games that they played with science, then, the sword cuts both ways. I think that if you look at, for example, omega-6, omega-3 content, the differences just are not there to be meaningful. They're far more variable. In other words, in one of my presentations, I dug out, I don't know, 10 or a dozen refereed articles where they reported omega-6 to omega-3 ratio in grass-fed versus grain-fed animals, and they varied tremendously. And some of them were not all that different from what we're told are these, you know, goals and guidelines. But if you look at the quantitative, not just the ratio, but the actual amounts that are in there, beef is not a rich source of omega-3 or omega-6, regardless of how it's finished. Another way to look at that is if somebody's going to say to me that they want grass-fed beef because it's going to have this desirable, you know, lower than 4-to-1 omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, that's fine. Just don't eat pork and don't eat poultry because they're going to have much higher than 4-to-1 ratio. And as a practical point, don't be eating vegetable oils.
Definitely not.
Although soybean oil has an omega-6 to omega-3 ratio that's 4-point-something, it's not, you know, so if you just look at the ratio, it's certainly lower than the chicken or the pork. But of course, it's got a much higher content, total content. And so we can get ourselves, I think, confused by focusing on ratio and not looking at amounts. And I also, having done a little bit of looking into the literature that gets us convinced about, you know, the omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids, I think that's another whole story that's waiting to be debunked. I've spoken to a number of people and read a number of reviews and articles that make me suspicious that we're dealing with another paradox. In other words, here we have yet another population that doesn't have, that has low coronary heart disease rate, but eats a lot of fat. And so, you know, first it's the Mediterraneans, it must be the olive oil, then it's the French, it must be the antioxidants, then it was the Greenland Eskimo. It must be the fish oil. There's a similar pattern involved in all these that makes me suspicious. And one of the points that I made a couple years ago at Ancestral Health was, we know from the literature that you can make tremendous improvements in people's health by exchanging calories from carbohydrate with calories from animal products, regardless of how they're produced, right? I mean, that's Atkins. That's low carbohydrate, high fat.
I have a theory on that. One of the things that you get by way of confounders is always, oh, I went on this vegan diet and I felt so much better, or I went vegetarian, or I went low fat, or I went, and I think that in all of those cases, including the low carb, high fat, is that a lot of the initial health improvements are not coming from what we're eating, but what we're not eating.
Yeah, and I think that, I think Taubes made the point that except on something like an Ornish diet that's so low in fat, but in any other kind of diet, you're going to be restricting carbohydrates somehow. And so the question is that the benefit that we're seeing? But it's clear that we've seen improvements in metabolic health as animal products were increased in the diet and carbohydrate was restricted of whatever form. And in speaking to some practitioners who've treated real life human beings, the question was, how many of those people, you know, how many of those people were eating, you know, organic produce or products? And the answer, of course, is none in their case because it wasn't available. And
or not affordable.
Exactly. And so, and when we're dealing with a condition that has a disproportionate impact on the economically disadvantaged, then we ought to be very, very cautious about espousing anything that's going to make it even more expensive for them to eat a diet which will help them restore their health, and especially when the data to support that is so thin. I've been thanked by people who, again, treat real-life human beings and do so serving this kind of a poor population, and they say thank you because now I can feel better about saying, you know, go get the eggs when they're on sale, right? And later down the road, we might be able to do something else. But right now, this is the most important thing.
I think there's not a whole lot of mileage in being a purist. All we have to do is be better.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You know, improvement. And one of the first things we have to do, of course, is get people to understand that what they thought was an improvement before might need to be reexamined. You know, healthy whole grains may not be. You know, yeah. Healthy fruit juices and those nasty sugar, you know, filled, corn syrup filled sodas may essentially be equivalent. But that's, again, part of the conversation that we need to
have. Yeah, and there's some other things. I don't think that macronutrients is the final answer to any of that stuff, because I've tracked down health problems to additives like you know, phosphoric acid or you know, artificial sweeteners. They don't seem to bother everybody, but they bother
right.
me. So the amount of fat or carbohydrate or protein that you're getting, I think, is kind of not all that important. As long as I keep the carbohydrate low, it seems to work pretty well for me.
Yeah, and clearly, you know, in our family, I'm more sensitive than my wife is, who's more sensitive than her mother, and her dad is, you know, the skinny little Italian kid that, you know, is still skinny. And so he's, you know, been that way. He has none of the health issues. So, yeah, he gets a roll with every meal at dinner, right? I mean, so, okay. I think the figuring out, using the tools that we now have that are available for people to figure things out. But again, the thought occurred to me, there's a wonderful German delicatessen up in Portland called Edelweiss Delicatessen. You can order from them online, and they make one of the most wonderful creations of mankind that I have ever seen. Imagine, if you will, taking a pork belly and curing it and making it into bacon. Okay? So now you've got a slab of bacon, cut a pocket in it, okay? And then stuff this with their bologna mixture that includes chunks of ham. Okay, then bake it. Then cool
it. Nose to tail, huh?
Bake it, cool it, slice it. You have this wonderful stuffed bacon. It's a joyous thing, and I'm sorry I'm going to have to wipe my mouth just thinking about it. I'm standing at the counter one day with a list of what we want, because it's 2 hours away from where we live. So, and this woman next to me is enjoying some sample that she's gotten. And she says to me, oh, it's all so delicious. And I said, yes, it is. And she said, but it's so bad for you. And I immediately assumed that she was talking about the saturated fat. And I, you know, gave her a little bit of, well, saturated fat isn't bad for you. No, I know that, she says. What she says is, it's so processed.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so processed food. So you're going to tell me that this epitome of man's charcuterie skills is the equivalent of Cocoa Puffs as far as being a processed food? I'm sorry, I don't think so. And then again, as you mentioned, nose to tail. What was that all about? It was being as efficient with this resource as you could be. It was taking all the bits and finding a way to use it. I mean, they have four different liverwurst recipes. And so. But we've been conditioned somehow to think that all processed food is bad. Is it? I'm not convinced.
Well, processing is processing. I mean, cooking is processing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Good point.
And as for the nose to tail, I ran across a little tidbit fairly recently from a diary of Lewis and Clark. And they were noticing that the Indians, basically, they would cut up a buffalo, they slaughter a buffalo, and they would take all the organ meats, the brains and the kidneys and the lungs and the heart and the liver and all that, and they would take all those and pack them up and take away, and they would leave the muscle meat for the buzzards.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of an interesting thing. We do pretty much the opposite.
Well, except that, and this is a point that Dr. Mike Eads shared with me. Just he was wondering, and I haven't followed up on it. He was wondering, in our selection for animals that have a predisposition for marbling, that's a genetic trait, as well as then our husbandry that produces those marbled cuts, muscles, meat. What have we done to increase the fat content of muscle above what it was when we were relying on game animals? How do those compare then to the bits that we used to prefer? Have we, he's asking the question, have we now sort of increase the supply of our preferred bits from these animals? So we require fewer animals to get what it is that we prefer to have. I need to do a little looking in an NRC database.
That's an interesting little tidbit, because most of the organ meats tend to be much fattier.
Yes, but I'm not aware of exactly what that fat content is. And again, it would take a little bit of time for me looking through the NRC database and get some information. But yeah, it's an interesting thought, at least.
Well, I hope that if not this year, maybe next year, we get to meet again on the low carb cruise. I've arranged my life so that I can be pretty much a regular on that cruise.
Nice.
And it's a write off for me, because I do most of my interviews for N equals one on that ship.
I see. Okay, fair enough.
I have certainly enjoyed speaking with you, and it looks like this particular take has done a lot better. I think that's largely because the technology on my end is a little better. I guess I'm not going to complain about Time Warner Cable. They're in the past now.
Yes, yes.
So I definitely appreciate you taking the time. Now, this was the third try, right?
I think so. Third, yeah. Well,
third or fourth.
Yeah, third day, let's put it that way.
Third day. So I'm really grateful that you agreed to a do-over, because that first try was so awful. The video was just terrible and jerky. And from what I can see here, it's turned out quite a bit better. I just hope the recording is okay. Well,
yes.
I'll let you know when we sign off. Anyway, thank you very much for coming back and visiting with me. And I hope to, if I don't see you on the cruise or on next year's cruise, maybe I'll follow up with you in a year or two and see how things are different.
Excellent. Happy New Year.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All righty. I think that's a wrap.
All righty. Excellent.
Bye.
Bye-bye.